So once again, good morning. It's good to be here with you. I hope you're not too sleepy from staying up and watching the Olympics. Has anyone been watching that yet? Our family was last night. Well, I was writing the sermon last night. I kept hearing the wows of my kids and the scores of the judges for they're watching figure skating last night. Yeah. Before I started my sermon, they're watching snowboarding. And unfortunately, Canada didn't quite do as well as we hoped. But it's good fun. It's often amazing, isn't it, to see human skill and talent on display. I mean, what human beings can do is incredible. Well, this morning, we're going to talk about money. And who doesn't like to talk about money? Well, we don't often do it in the church. And the truth is, we're not going to talk about money exactly. We're going to focus a bit more on wealth, on having excess money, more than what you simply need for your needs, money with which you can choose to use. And who doesn't want some of that? I mean, is anyone going to turn down wealth? It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Has anyone here had an experience of unexpected wealth? A time in your life where you received something you didn't expect? Perhaps an inheritance? Perhaps a trust fund that you didn't know about? A wealthy relative, perhaps, supported you in school or in business, some adventure of yours, in ways that you didn't expect? It's never been my reality to have that experience. But I hear it happens, and those are great stories to tell. But there have been times in my life where I had more than I needed. And you know what, frankly, that's exhilarating. That's fantastic. I mean, I did not grow up poor by any means, that's not my story. But I did grow up in a family that lived with constant constraints, constant urgencies, constant needs. So, you know, where our money went was fairly dictated for us. In fact, I'm the one that lent money to my parents often at times. So the experience of having choice, of having enough to buy what I wanted, was really a thrill, actually. No, I don't think that's bad. That's not a bad thing. There's something good about having the opportunity to learn about oneself through the ability to make choices. For whether we have a lot of excess or even just a little, a large part of the benefit of disposable income is exactly that. It's choice. The freedom of options. Now, with options, you have to make judgments, don't you? You know, unless you got a really big trust fund. But for most of us, you got to make judgments, right? Why this choice and not that choice? You can't have it all. And alongside judgments are always values. What's important to me? What do I value? And then underneath all that package, driving the whole shebang, are desires. Who or what do we love? Choices put all those dynamics into play in our lives. Options require judgments, which reveal values, which are driven by desires. And often those dynamics are actually hidden from us, apart from having enough to make a choice in the first place. Often we're a mystery to ourselves, right? The story we tell about who we are is different from who we actually are, who you see when you have enough to actually do something, right? We think we're kind and generous until that time in which we're actually able to be really generous. Then we might discover, not that we're bad people, we don't wish ill on anyone else, but we might discover that we're actually a lot more fearful, that we're a lot more anxious about the future than we thought we were. And it's really hard to let go of those excess funds. You know, sometimes this opportunity to learn about ourselves doesn't even show up in our lives till quite late. There's enough expenses in life, right? A lot of you are students. You're not, you know, to stay a student, you got to write some pretty hefty checks to the university. And then after university, you might get married, and that's expensive too, and you might have some kids, and those are definitely expensive, require a few checks there as well. And mortgages, and on it goes. So you might actually end up where you don't have a lot of disposable income. You might not have a lot of excess, a lot of wealth, let's say, until you're a bit later in your life. You might be in your late, mid to late 40s. Your kids are starting to exit home. Some of those expenses are paid. And you're at your peak earnings, and you may have some stability with your housing. And all of a sudden, you find yourself with some financial freedom. Finally. What will you do? What choices will you make? And what will those choices and actions reveal about who you are. But today's parable is a very simple one. It's found in Luke 12, 13 to 21. It's known as the parable of the rich farmer, or the parable of the foolish farmer. Let's read it. Luke 12, 13 to 21. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist of an abundance of possessions." And then he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." He said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus again. I'll say to myself, you've laid up grain. You've plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. This is the word of the Lord. Let's pray. Jesus, we ask that you would send your Spirit among us. Help me to faithfully retell this story and talk about it. Help us to all together faithfully hear it. And we're grateful that it's you telling the story, because you are the giver of all good gifts and you are the redeemer of all who are lost. Amen. You know, it's always tricky talking to Jesus, isn't it? So as much as we like to put Jesus in a box sometimes, right? We think we know what Jesus is going to say. Sometimes we encourage each other that way, right? We were talking to someone and want to pray with someone and they got this issue in their life and, well, this is what Jesus would say. And a lot of times that's great stuff. You know, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But the truth is, when you actually read the Gospels, you're just never quite sure what he's actually going to say, right? He doesn't always follow the script that you think he's going to. The script that the Jesus in your head actually would say. In this case, someone with a grievance, a sense of personal injustice, comes to Jesus. Jesus is probably the most righteous rabbi he knows. And this person asks Jesus to be an advocate for him. Rabbis did that sort of thing in those days. "Jesus," he says, "I've got a social justice issue for you. I'm being exploited economically by my own family, nonetheless. My wealthy older brother refuses to give me what is rightfully mine. You know what the law says, Jesus, and he's on the wrong side of it. Can you tell him to do the right thing? He'll listen to you. You know, he's interested in you. He's here in this crowd. Just say the word and he'll listen. This whole mess will be straightened out and put right." And Jesus says, "No problem. You, over there, stop hoarding. Stop taking what belongs to your brother. Stop that." Oh, sorry, that's not quite right. That's from a much later Sojourner's article that I read. Almost no one got that. How does Luke show Jesus actually responding? He says the funniest thing. He basically says a version of, "How is this my business?" Right? "How is this my business?" Followed by a fairly sharp, "Watch out for greed. Life is not about lots of stuff." This is not exactly what this young man wanted to hear. But like I said, you never know what you're going to get when you ask Jesus a question. You might just get a story. In this case, a story about a farmer, a rich one. You know, he was already doing quite well for himself. For Jesus says he was rich right from the beginning. And yet it gets better. He gets better. He gets a bumper crop. His fields are overflowing with abundance, and that means his bank account is also about to overflow with abundance as well. That is if he can monetize it. For if he doesn't get it off the fields and into storage, all that grain is worthless, right? And although he's done well before, he's never, ever done this well. So he does the prudent thing. It's a smart thing. You don't waste something like this. This is a bumper crop, and they don't come around very often. The smart thing to do is to build what you need to store the crop, to not waste any of it. He's a careful man. I mean, we would all do the same thing, wouldn't we? I mean, this is smart. He's not about to spend all this money right away. He needs to store it. It's a bank account. So he does the wise thing with his abundance that he's been blessed with, and he checks on what contribution room he has available in his RSP account. And then he decides that, well, that's fairly full, actually. I'll just max that out, and then I'll put the rest into a TFSA account and stuff it all up, and then I'll be secure. So those two barns, those two bank accounts, should be able to hold all his wealth and secure him for the future. For the great thing about being prudent as he is that you can make your money go a long, long time. Right? The rich man probably earned more in this one bumper crop than he was planning to earn in another 10 years. Well, that takes the edge off his 5 to 10 year plans, doesn't it? His fields will still provide income, but now he's set for life. He's made what he needs. He can eat, he can drink, he can be merry. He's got enough for some hired hands to work the farm for him. He's now on Easy Street. Life is looking pretty sweet. The good life has come, and he's pretty chuffed about it. He deserves it, after all. For he's the one who's been working hard. Those are his fields. Those are his crops. That's his grain, his barn, his surplus. Notice that in three short verses, this farmer uses either I or my language over 10 times. He's rightfully entitled to what's his, isn't he? Aren't we? Well, it's into this place of ownership and entitlement that God speaks. You know, interestingly, this parable is actually the only parable in all of Scripture where God is a character in the story. There's other characters in Jesus' parables that clearly are meant to represent God. But this is the only story Jesus tells where Jesus puts words right into the mouth of God. God speaks directly. This is serious stuff. For what does God say? He says three things. Three devastating things. Number one, you fool. God names him. He calls this wise and prudent businessman a fool. Now, this is a fool in Hebrew thought. There's a couple types of fools out there. I mean, there's not just one kind of fool. So this is not the kind of fool Jesus is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, don't call someone a fool. That one's a little bit more like how many of us talk when we're driving, right? That's one kind of fool. That's not what's going on here. This is not an idiot. This is a moral fool, right? This is not someone who isn't smart. This is someone who isn't wise. Number two, second thing Jesus says, or God says, your life will be demanded from you. You know, this very entitled farmer who owned so much and so confidently labeled all that he owned as mine, he missed a very important but basic truth. Your very own life is not yours. You have no control over when, to whom, or where you were born. You will have no control over when and where you die. You did not start the story of your life. And you know what? You won't finish it either. you were born into, and you've lived in, and you will die in, as part of a much, much larger story that you did not author, you did not control, and you will certainly not finish. Well, the truth is, life, all of our lives, is a gift. It is given to you, and it is taken away from you. It was never, ever yours. At least never in the sense of ownership, but always in the sense of stewardship. Is anyone a Lord of the Rings fan? Right? What's Denethor's mistake? Denethor was a steward, but he started acting like a king. He forgot his place, and everything went downhill. Third thing God says, then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? Well, here's the rub. All that planning, all that preparation, all that hoping and dreaming, all those goals, all driven and enabled by wealth, all that was a basic failure of discernment. For the question this farmer never asked, this rich man never asked, was, who am I called to bless with the blessing I've received? Right? Who am I called to bless with the blessing that I've received? All his preparation, all his prudence, all his business savvy, all these gifts were used to prepare for himself. That's it. It all cycled back. They were not gifts for the blessing of the world. They weren't gifts for the blessing of his neighbors. They weren't gifts for the blessing of his community, for the poor or for the needy. No, he had one thought. It's one person in his world. It's himself. So he was blessed indeed. And he was happy to put the period right there. I am blessed. He was quite comfortable with that sentence. So Jesus ends this short story with a simple teaching point. Verse 21. This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. Well, there we go. Let's sum it up. Money is bad, or at least a temptation. Wealth is evil. And number three, if you get rich, God is going to kill you. Okay, did you get that? You have those 3 points down? Okay, let's invite the band up, and we're going to... Don't you wish it was that easy and clear? That'd be nice, right? At least morally it'd be nice. It might not so be nice lifestyle-wise. But at least we'd feel quite self-righteous in our poverty as we started to make the best of it. And to be honest, that is how some Christians, not all of them, but some Christians talk about wealth and money, isn't it? You get that impression. And, you know, the truth is, some of those Christians talk about wealth and money in those terms for some good reasons, because Jesus himself is not shy to discuss wealth and money. And the hard truth is, it's rarely positive. I mean, Luke, where this parable is in, Luke and Acts, Luke has a lot of concern. Almost every chapter of Luke and Acts has some kind of financial concern in it. And it's about a 90 to 10 ratio, negative to positive, right? 90% negative, it's only about 10% positive. So the people who speak very pejoratively about wealth have a good deal of ammo to work with. Because the truth is, like we talked about earlier at the beginning of the sermon, wealth gives us power. It allows us to make choices and to pursue our desires. Because while it's possible to be both good and wealthy, that is possible. It's not that probable, is it? Our hearts betray our best intentions. And there's no shortage of stories out there about the destructive power of wealth in people's lives. People that come into wealth and it actually enables their darkest longings and their darkest desires. It ruins their life. I got one example from Alberta that I'm from. I know Alberta's got a bad rap these days, but leave your tomatoes at home. And it's kind of a silly example, but I think it illustrates this. A few years ago, Alberta was running hotter than hot, wasn't it? Oil was up, economy was bursting. The Tim Hortons around the area where I'm from, where my parents, my wife's parents are from, there's, you know, Tim Hortons everywhere in Alberta. They couldn't find employees, right? My brother remembers going to work one day, and this is a Dairy Queen in this example, but you know they got those outside signs that they put on the lawn with the letters that you put in? So we went to work, and it said, and you got to realize minimum wage was lower, right? It's about $9 an hour back then. We went to work, it said $10 an hour. Came back from work, it said $11 an hour. He went to work the next day, it said $12 an hour. Came back from work, it said $13 an hour. Went back to work the next day, it said $14. And came back and it said $14 an hour with benefits. A Dairy Queen, right? That's how hot the economy was. They could not find enough employees to keep open. There's actually in St. Albert, where I'm from, the same guy owns, I think, almost all but one of the Tim Hortons in town. He had to close some of them because he couldn't find workers. That's how hot the economy is running. So into that kind of scenario, there's a farming couple. So my wife's from the Mayo, which is just outside of Edmonton, agricultural community. And this farming couple was just your everyday average farming couple. I mean, they had a farm, they had a modest life, you know, a modest house, and not a very wealthy existence, not poor either. It was a good life. Until the price of oil went sky high. Does anyone know what's on a lot of the farms in Alberta? Oil wells, that's right. Now, most of them have been dormant for 20 or 30 years, right? They were pumping oil back in the late 70s and the early 80s, but when oil went back down again, they were never activated again. That takes a certain price to activate those wells because it's just not worth it otherwise. When oil went sky high, these oil wells on these property were activated, and so they started rolling in the dough, because they get a fee for all that sort of stuff. So they went out and they bought a motorhome. They bought one of those big ones, those race car driver motorhomes, you know, the big Greyhound bus motorhomes. Pretty sweet deal. That's a luxury, but, you know, they're an elderly farming couple. Who's going to begrudge them, right? They're in their late 50s. They're getting older. They want to travel. They've got the money. So, what's that? Yeah, yeah. They're mature. They're mature people. Yeah. Forget the last 35 seconds. Just wipe those clean. These two spring chickens, they got this motorhome. And it arrives, and it's a pretty sweet ride, right? I mean, this is not just your average motorhome. It's not a Winnebago. This is a big, gleaming, incredible, customized thing. But it wasn't enough. So this rural Alberta farmer's wife had the floors ripped out and had slate imported from Italy to lay inside this motorhome, along with other very pricey and expensive customizations. Now, I mean, that's just tacky, too. But at one level, you might say, what's the harm, right? They got the money, you know, they're going to die in 20 years. So they want to travel. But on another level, you might say, what prompted exactly a farming couple with a modest, good income, stability, what prompted them to order Italian slate for their motorhome? Who knew that they were that discontented? Who knew they were that envious of others? Who knew that they were so desirous of not just having the best? I mean, not very many people own a motorhome like that, right? So they didn't make it just an incredibly spiffy motorhome. They made it the very best motorhome in all of Alberta, by far. Why was that so important to them? What did wealth reveal about who they were? You know, this doesn't mean that money is bad or that wealth is evil. But it does mean that choices reveal who we are. And those choices are enabled by wealth. Money enables the choices and opens up new possibilities where they didn't exist before. It's kind of like the saying. Does anyone know the saying, power corrupts and? That's right. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we say that usually around election years. But you know what? That's not actually true. I always have a beef with that statement. Because power doesn't corrupt. It's much like money. It reveals. And absolute power, it is true, on a human level, absolute power is a terrifying thing. Because there is no human heart so pure that absolute power would not be put to destructive and damaging ends. Often, and this is the thing where it's hard to tell the limits of power, and where people are sometimes willing to give people more power than they should, often with the very best of intentions. Often the very worst things are done for righteous causes. And I think here you can pick basically any communist regime or almost any inner city housing project as case studies. Really. Both done for the best of intentions, but both incredibly dehumanizing and disempowering. Power is best diffused as preventative medicine, right? That's why we love democracy in the West. It's difficult to get things done in a democracy. The only thing harder is getting things done in a Baptist church, probably, right? Committees ad nauseum. But the thing in a democracy is that at least bad things, as well as good things, are both hard to do quickly. So if wealth itself is not the problem, what is Jesus trying to teach us here? Well, he's trying to help us frame our lives through two main points. These are the two main points of the parable. Point number one, the selfish accumulation of wealth is incompatible with true discipleship. Our basic call is to follow Jesus with all of our hearts, soul, mind, and strength. And number two, our lives are gifts. They are not our own. We are all going to be held account to someday for how we use these gifts of life that we have. It includes our time, our energy, our skills, our gifts, and yes, even our wealth. So what would this look like in the real world? What would it look like if we were wealthy? Some of you may be. Or some of you may be actually in careers that are heading in that direction. Right? It's not that you're pursuing wealth, but you just happen to be in a career that's going to end up with substantial resources. Or you're from a family, perhaps, that'll give you certain opportunities that way, that are heading in that direction. Well, I don't want to be overly prescriptive. And I shouldn't be, right? It's not for me to say. These things about how we use our wealth need personal and communal, we need to do this together because of our hearts, discernment. So we do this individually and together. But I'm just going to make a little effort here to stir our creative juices, to get some creative thinking going about how we could use wealth in ways that are, in Jesus' words, rich towards God. So let's throw out a few ideas. Idea number one, I'd encourage you to tie together financial support with relational investment. Try to give relationally. It's another way of saying try to give to people you actually know. This hopefully means your local church, right? Hopefully you trust Redemption enough to give here, to invest in the ministries here, to invest in the people here. But it also means other ministries that you're a part of, right? I'm very tied both to Redemption Church and to Regent College. And my giving goes to both places. Support those that you trust financially. But for many of us, we can do more and we want to do more. So if you're interested in other ministries, if you're interested in other, if you can, you know, one of the ways to think about calling is to see how would you describe the question? What would be your answer to the question, what is wrong with the world? That'll give you a hint to how God's wired you. So say you're concerned about homelessness. Well, try to partner with a ministry and actually meet some homeless people. Right? Actually invest relationally in them. to get to know who they, what they actually need, to hear their story a bit, to get to know them as persons, not just as statistics. If you have both time and money, I do encourage you to try investing both. But let's be honest about what this means. When you invest relationally, it will become awkward and difficult and, frankly, disappointing. Because we are all people in need of grace, and we will let each other down. It's much, much easier to give to that big NGO that, in response to your gift, sends you a glossy magazine showing the powerful impact of your donor money across the world. That's easier to do. But trust me, your investment in that NGO, the inside story to that investment, is much, much messier than probably you want to know. That's just the way life is. That doesn't mean we shouldn't give. It means that in giving relationally, we have the opportunity to grow in mercy and in grace and in perseverance with people. It will grow us up. Now, the thing I didn't mention in the sermon, but probably should, is it will also grow us up because we will also have to learn to receive. That's the other part of investing relationally. We have to be givers and receivers. Reciprocity needs to be at play. I do want to say at the end of this one, though, that doesn't mean you shouldn't give to large NGOs, right? Because the truth is, we can't know everybody. And there are lots of people who, just logistically, it's impossible. You will never be able to meet them. But they do need your resourcing. They do need your investment. So it is not bad to give to an NGO. But if you want to think how to invest in ways that are rich towards God, think about investing relationally. Number two, I'd encourage you to stop oversimplifying. Stop having less. Now, it's different from saying have more, and I get that this sounds weird, particularly in Vancouver, right? Because we're both an incredibly materially rich city, right? I mean, every time my family comes to visit, it's just a different location here. It's like, oh, is that a, I mean, last night we're driving home. Oh, is that a Lamborghini parked on the side of the road by our house? Right? And everyone's heads turn. There's a Lamborghini. Whereas, you know, when you're in Edmonton, oh, is that a new F-250? Right? You know, that's, it's just a different world. Is that 250 driving over a Prius? Yes, yes, it is. Yes, yes, yes. But I just want to make a plea. And this is all provisional. This is me, not God, obviously, right? But what if instead of focusing on having less, right, as if just simplifying itself was a means of virtue? What about if we change the question? What if we said instead, how can this bless? How can this bless? Right? Let's stop feeling guilty for what we have, but instead let's touch what we have and say, how can this bless? Marva Dawn, who used to teach at Regent sometimes, she gave away all her book royalties, and people asked her, how do you discern what to spend? She said, I have a simple rule. I don't buy anything without answering two questions. Will this help me love God more? And will this help me love my neighbor more? Everything she bought went through that lens. Will this help me love God more? And will it help me love my neighbor more? I think there's a lot of wisdom there. A lot of wisdom. But counterintuitively, think about what that might mean for us here in this city. Because I want to make a plea that if you have or can afford a large house in the city, I'd encourage you to buy it. Right? Don't give it up. Don't move into a condo. Because if you are willing to use that place as a place of hospitality, you can be a huge blessing to this city and a huge impact on the church. Huge. When we were planting U-Town up at UBC, that church would have been hard-pressed to survive if it wasn't for Marty Furse, a former elder in this church, who was a man who started and launched two companies and had a high degree of wealth. He bought a large house on that property, which hosted a church, right? Because we kept getting kicked out of buildings at U-Town. And so when we're in between spaces, we met in his front lawn, and there was enough space for us all. His abundance was used and offered as a gift to the flourishing ministry of the city. His house became a launching pad for mission at UBC. Right? If he would have simplified, we wouldn't have had any place to go. So it's not about having less. It's about how can we use what we have to bless. Same thing goes if you have a business. If you have a business that's flourishing, that's not bad, right? You can employ and give skills to people so that they might flourish. That might actually be your calling in this city, to employ people, to bless them, to mentor them, to encourage them, to help them gain skills in this world, in service and ministry. This may be your investment in people's lives. Work is important. Good work is important. It's fundamental to our human vocation. Sometimes we're in danger of talking in the church as if we have one mission, right? That our mission is redemptive. That all we need to do is go out there and tell people about Jesus. That is not the case. That is not our primary calling, right? Genesis 1 and 2, our primary calling, we are put here as God's image on this earth, as his stewards for this planet, to work. That's our primary calling, to work and form and shape and mold and develop this planet, not exploitively, but to help bring out the best here. That's our original vocation. Now, we messed that up, and so we've had another vocation that's had to come along, right? God has come and rescued us out of our sin, and he's given us a redemptive vocation so that as we're going out there, we tell people about the good news about Jesus, about that we can participate in God's restoration. We can participate in God's good work in this world. But those are not mutually exclusive. Sometimes we talk about, well, we need to work just so we can do this other thing. That's not how it works. We can do both at the same time. We can go out there and do good work in this world, good stewardship work, and tell people about Jesus as we're doing it. Does that make sense? Yeah. What you're studying is important. What you guys work at is important. The kind of ways that you serve and bless people, most of the good that gets done in this world gets done through the market. Do you realize that? Sometimes we talk about the market as if it's all about Enron and other exploitive banks and all the rest, Goldman Sachs. And that is a part of it, right? Human sin and evil is there. But think about all the blessing that comes to the market. Where do you buy your groceries? Where do you get your bread? Where do you get your gas? Who insures you? All sorts of ways that we are provided for through the good work being done out there. That is, a lot of the times those bakers, they're not there just to get rich. They have skills that they're offering the community that you pay for, right? Self-interest and selfishness are not the same thing. They're not the same thing. So join your creative, God-given vocation to work in this world with your redemptive vocation to testify to the good news that he is also redeeming it. And he can make us into the kind of people who can actually use our work to be a blessing. That's what God will do in your lives. He will enable this to become this. Number three, just to be more creative, think about investing your savings in ways that can bless people. You know, Paul Williams, former prophet at Regent College and a former elder of this church, was keen on starting a credit union. We talked about that many times in our leadership meetings. As one way of addressing the housing crisis in Vancouver, an enabling mission in the city, right? We all have portions of our long-term investments, which are low yield, but also low risk, right? You've got that portion, usually about 20% of portfolio, and then other stuff is in medium risk and then high risk. Well, he had said, what if we repurpose those funds, right? Right if giving that over to Sun Life or whatever channel that we do that in, what if we took that portion of it and put it into a credit union and lent that out to people, and purposely lending that out to people to enable mortgages of those city for people that were invested in the city for the long term, invested in the city's flourishing, invested in mission in this city. What if we had a credit union that could help the Christian community grow here instead of getting forced out like everyone else? Just one creative idea. Now, would that take a lot of work? Yes, it would. We need some people with some very particular skill sets to make that happen. We were never quite able to form that kind of team. It's too much load for one person to bear, particularly with Paul's load at the time. But wouldn't that have been creative? That would have been a lot of fun. Number four, in a slightly different direction. I want you to consider taking stock of your life. Last week we talked about doing a life audit and what that might reveal. But also want you to think about that it might be a very healthy thing to consider your life in light of the end. It can be a very encouraging practice, sobering, but also very directive for your life, to write your own obituary. I know that sounds bizarre, but think about it. What do you want people to say about you when you're gone? What do you want to be known for? How do you want to sum up your life? You know, it's a wise person indeed who begins with the end in mind in whatever vocation you're doing. Begin with the end in mind. That's not actually morbid. That's just wise to do that. I'm actually thinking of having my kids do it on their birthdays. We'll see if I can get away with that. So these four ideas, they're not necessarily simple, but they're also not impossible. Hopefully can spark some creativity. It's a lot of fun, actually, when we get on the blessing train to start to dream about blessing, about being a people whose gifts are a channel of grace to others. But lastly, what if you don't have a lot of wealth? Or if your bank account's not that high? What does this parable say about you? Well, I do want to encourage you. It says exactly the same thing. For the whole point is that we are called to live lives that are rich towards God. Now, your life might not be a wealthy life in financial terms, but it is a gift nonetheless, each one of you. And the way that you spend that gift in blessing and service is in a life rich towards God. Which I want to remind you, and take one famous person you all know, this is not unlike Jesus' own life. Think about Jesus' life and ministry. Jesus' own life was quite modest, right? Born in a stable, raised a carpenter's son. It's probably kind of, I mean, these are anachronistic terms, but lower middle class. But with no place to lay his head, right? He had no home to go to. How did Jesus do what he did for 3 years? It's pretty hard to live with no home for 3 years of ministry. Well, he did what he did by having wealthy benefactors follow him around and support his mission. Right? These wealthy women that are mentioned in these Gospels are the ones who are supporting Jesus. They're providing places for him. He's being hosted by people like Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Jesus' mission couldn't have been accomplished without the generous participation of wealthy donors. You ever think about that? It didn't come out of nowhere. We all give the gifts that we have. We're not called to give the gifts we don't have. Give what you have. And God doesn't have favorites. There's no pecking order here, right? If you got a big bank account, God doesn't see you as better than the person who doesn't have much. God doesn't have favorites. What God does have is callings. And we are all called to give where he leads. Because this morning, I want to end with, I hope you know that your life is a gift. Judah, your life is a gift. Katrina, your life is a gift. Right? Richard, your life is a gift. For all of you, Michael, your life is a gift. It's a gift that's meant to be gifted. And I hope that you find Redemption Church to be a place that you can give those gifts. Right? And give and receive. This is the thing. It's not just about giving. To give your gifts, to receive the gifts of others, so that together we might be a community of blessing. Of blessing and being blessed. Of giving and receiving. God's economy is an economy of grace. It's a giving and receiving economy of grace. Remember, like I said, the market accomplishes most of the good things that go on in the world? That might be true, but we all know it's distorted too, doesn't it? One of the ways that we want to give our gifts to each other here in this world is to show them the missing piece. Because they're struggling to find it, but they don't quite get it. It's in here that we can use our resources with each other to show them what an economy of grace looks like. And then we can be like a light on the hill, shining in Vancouver, displaying true economic wisdom through the grace and gift of God. So this morning, let's move into God's economy, where you are all receive your lives of grace and gift, and you're called to give them. It's an economy of grace and gift and love. Let's pray. Father of lights, giver of all good gifts, we are grateful for our lives. As hard as they might be at times, as many challenges as you've pulled us through, yet each one of us is wonderful, is beautiful, is called to be restored, to be made more so by your Spirit. Help us to enter into your economy. Pray that you would chip away at the fear and the anxiety that drives the market out there, and instead replace that with a hopefulness and a sense of grace that can drive our own service to each other. May life flourish here, first of all, but then that overflows in abundance to this city. That is a work of your Spirit. So we humbly ask you to gift us all the more to be that kind of place. A place that looks like you are king. An economy that responds to your grace. Amen.